This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to This Week in Wrestling Indies International. I'm Pete, and of course I'm with Timothy. Timothy, man, what is going on?
Oh, same old, same old. Getting excited. G1 has started. Obviously, we'll be covering it. It's the start of the summer season. Lots of tournaments going on. Bola, SCI, we talked about last week. So it's that time of year again, huh?
Yeah, I know. The network is uploading a lot of old school footage. Put up a lot of world class up on the network today. Dropped some more Madison Square Garden and Boston Garden house shows on it. So that's something I was hoping for when it first launched. Finally, they're realizing they have the stuff ready to go. Might as well just upload it. It's cheaper than taping an episode of Swerve or whatever and stuff. So there we go. I have Wrestle Circus tomorrow. I'll be checking that out live. It should be a pretty fun show. Hope it doesn't go as long as 5.5 hours, but it's a pretty fun show. And they're actually following our lead, and they're main eventing with their women's with Rachel Ellering. We've talked about ad nausea, as we feel like Rachel could headline a show. Well, they're giving her the slot versus Tessa Blanchard. And I guess they're also going off the momentum of the women's tournament going on right now over at Full Sail. What do you think?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they do now. We both said, you know, the last time that these two had a match that it could have easily been the main event of the Wrestle Circus show. So I'm excited to see that. I'm excited to see what Wrestle Circus does now that they bought the building, the big top that they were trying to get people to help them purchase. Now they've officially kind of got that. Yeah, which is going to be interesting to see. And
It's not open yet, but I think it's a game changer for them. It gives them a lot more flexibility. If you own the building, man, you can survive hard times. You can survive not drawing as well when you're getting all the money on the concession and not having to rent out a building, if you will, you know?
Yeah, no, definitely. And with them, you know, I mean, it's no secret Al was on our show, and he said that their model is kind of AAW, PWG inspired. And with PWG now officially announcing the ticket prices for Bola this year, with the front row being over $100 and the general admission being $85, it's going to be interesting to see where Wrestle Circus ends up if they see this and think, oh, maybe we should increase our ticket prices as well, if this becomes a trend or not. I doubt it, but it is something to think about.
Oh yeah, it's definitely got a lot of buzz on the internet, and yeah, it's true. If people are willing to buy it, I mean, that's not an outlandish demand, you know. It's all supply and demand. If people meet it, then you're really not. You're. If people are buying it, that's the market value, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're foolish not to charge it if you can get it. So
exactly. Why would you, if you can make $1,000 on something? Why would you sell it for $25? I mean, it makes zero sense. But hey, that's that. So we might talk about Wrestle Circus in a week or two. Are you going to watch it on the Twitch app?
Maybe. I'll have to double check and see, because I don't know that I'm subscribed right now. And I know that the Twitch app on Roku, for me, would only let me watch the live stuff before, but I haven't checked it to see if it's working and what I'll think about it. But I'll look into it. I might end up watching it. I probably will, depending on when it is. It's tomorrow night. If I'm free at the time, I'll go for it.
Yeah, you know, it's going to have Donovan Dijak, one of his last shows before he heads out to NXT or the WWE, wherever they have him penciled in at. Same with Leo Rush. So it's always fun to wish these guys goodbye and stuff. And always cool. And stuff like that.
Yeah, and speaking of that, it's going to be another interesting one with Dijak officially being announced for, you know, reporting to NXT next month. If he's another guy who does he show up at Bola or not at this point? Is it enough out that they're going to expect him to cancel, or is he going to fulfill that date? It's interesting, especially because PWG doesn't tend to announce stuff like that until the last minute, no matter what. So you kind of have a bunch of time to think about it.
Exactly. But hey, let's get right into some of the stuff we're going to watch today. And we're going to open up with CWF Mid-Atlantic. And we open up with Logan Easton LaRue. And he's the new Ultra J champion. Yeah, I guess he beat Chet Sterling somewhere. I liked his promo to set up a four-way for the title, for a title shot, Adam. What about you?
Yeah, I really enjoyed the promo. I'm with you on that. I like that he won the title in Nova Pro, great little indie company that's kind of sister promotions with CWF, as they both tend to use that Ultra J championship pretty regularly. So connecting the two storylines works for me. And yeah, he sets up the, I think it's, is it a four-way contendership match? I think it is.
Yep.
And his promo is solid stuff. And again, as we talked about before, they presented him like a big deal. I think they probably got the Iggy from the Nova Pro guys that they were planning on switching that belt. So they knew that they should probably bring this guy in if they want to keep that belt active on their show. And they made him a big deal from the jump. And now he's off and running.
Yeah, and he's a fresh, you know, he's kind of a fresh shot in the arm for the company. And, you know, for a company that's, you know, not considered like a super indie, you know, like a PWG or an Evolve, they have a really deep roster, and they bring in a lot of interesting faces throughout the roster, and they make everything really, really click. It's I think they have a really it's a shockingly how deep of a roster they really have.
Well, and they have a good system of relationships with other promotions, off and on, relationship with Chikara that's been going for years, relationships with CZW by way of Dojo Wars, and, you know, MLJ, who's, you know, obviously a really great guy doing those Dojo Wars shows and a good commentator. And those relationships work really well for CWF because they get in on the ground floor with the guys when they're young, and then they can come back later when they're, you know, thought of as more of a bigger deal on the indie scene, and they have a history in the company, so it's a no-brainer to bring them in, but now they look like stars. It's like, I mean, they had been using Lance Lude forever, and then when the Ugly Ducklings thing kind of became hot, they bring him back in, and he's got so much history in this company already, but also he's part of a hot act that's over in other places. So it's, I mean, they've really got a great situation going for them. I guess they also have a relationship with PWX as well.
Yes, exactly. And and then we get this four-way with versus King, versus Gabriel, versus Monix, versus Tracer X. And I honestly can say I was not familiar with three of these four guys. And I thought this was a really super fun sprint. I like how they take out the two guys early. And we're able to get a story here. We got a lot of fun high spots. But I thought it was a really good way to get these guys over and make them kind of players here at CWF. Like, you really want to see any one of these four come out and wrestle some more. They did really well. They got about 7 minutes, had like a good three and a quarter star match, and got over with the crowd. The crowd dug it. And now these guys can come in and they can, you know, plug him in wherever, and they have some now cachet because they had a really fun debut. And then Tracer X, who the only guy I was really familiar with and who I assumed was going to win because he was the only one who's been in the company for a while, worked with the company with some form of longevity. He really, he won and what we expected. And I think Tracer X versus Logan Easton LaRue sounds like a real fun match. What do you make of everything here?
Yeah, Logan can keep up with Tracer if he wants to, but he probably choose not to with his heel persona. He's really slowed down his offense, and he may have been known for being a little bit more high energy in a former gimmick that he had. I don't know. He never wore a mask, so I think it's fair to say who he was, I guess, before he was who he is now. But so having, you know, Tracer X, as you said, looks big. This is a great match that shows that there's a competitive junior division in CWF, which has felt a little bit on the back burner. But now you got a new heel champion. You're going to instantly, as you said, make some credible babyface or challengers for him down the line, possibly all in one match. Great action all around. I mean, I agree with you every way, and it's and the thing of it is that when you've got a brand new champion who's maybe a little bit unknown to the faithfuls, having all these guys fight and have this really awesome spot fest, it gets them over, like you said. But underneath that, it gets him over, and it gets the title over, because they're acting like fighting him and trying to get that title is worth doing this and having this match. So, I mean, that's just basic wrestling 101, but it just really goes to show that when you do it right, you can get five guys over in one four-way match if you do it right.
Yeah, I thought Cecil was really good on commentary explaining how these guys are now made here in the CWF. I thought that was a good touch. And makes them seem like players when the announcing gives them a stamp of approval. Then we get a Matt Nix promo and an Aspen Rose and Aaron Epic promo. What you make of these?
Nix was fine in that he didn't stumble, but honestly, he comes across like just a guy. Really no star power to me at all.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, Aspen Rose starting out and then getting interrupted by Aaron Epic is good. I think Aspen, as the last time we saw her, is more of this mermaid character. Now she's bringing in this kind of darker character. It kind of works perfectly to get this guy over as a heel, because he seems like he's the bad influence. He's being controlling. He's R. Kelly-ing her, if you will, telling her what she can and can't do and when she's allowed to speak. So I think that works for getting this a guy over pretty quickly as a heel when you have a cute ex-babyface who seems to be under his spell. And so I thought that worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I agree with you on that half, and I enjoyed Epic as a promo. I thought he did a pretty good job carrying the segment in a way. Then we got the boar of Moldova versus Joshua Cutshaw. What you make of this?
This was really work. I hate to say it, like, because it sounds a bit condescending to these guys, but it felt like a low-level Haas fight. Like, this wasn't BJW Strong Division or even, you know, something with Chris Hero or Michael Elgin, but it was like just a step below those guys, but in the same vein as heavy hitters, strong style, big elbow strikes, and I kind of liked it for that. It felt like a stiff shot, a strike fest. They were pretty evenly matched, and two guys that maybe are aspiring to get to that next level, to be, you know, on that top-level brawler at some point. So I kind of liked that, in that it didn't go over the top. It didn't feel like they're trying to kind of knock off All Japan or something from the 90s. They didn't feel like, you know, yeah, like knock off Kobashi versus Kawada or something. But they felt like guys who are aspiring to that someday, but they know that they're not there yet, which I kind of really enjoyed it for that. Thought that it did a good job of getting Cutshaw over. I love the unhinged character. He's really leaning into it in a way that works really nice for me. And I mean, you know, this is quick in and out, hard-hitting action, and this is the kind of match that I think fills out your undercard on a show like this really well and leaves you with a, you know, like a good experience for a match that didn't, I mean, at the end of the day, they didn't do a lot. They didn't have to go crazy. They didn't even have a lot of time, but it made Cutshaw, it really got his character over moving forward, and it was just, like I said, just a nice little bit of business.
Yeah, I liked it too. I like Cutshaw as this crazy character. And the first thing I see when he's coming out with that mask, I'm like, man, he's been watching some Kevin Sullivan tapes. And that's the first thing Stutzy goes, makes a Kevin Sullivan comparison. And then I'm like, you know what? I could see Cutshaw in a stable like a Kevin Sullivan. And I could actually see the Bora Moldova kind of with him. As I mean, because you got to be a little crazy to be wearing that get up, you know? You can't be a sane person to dress up as a boar.
Yeah, right.
I could see them as a cornerstone of a stable, going with a kind of a crazy stable, playing off like the Kevin Sullivan from Florida, or the Kevin Sullivan from Continental type of, or even Kevin Sullivan from Tennessee type of thing. And I could kind of buy it, and in CWF, I think it would work, because their fans are such an old school, a lot of them are still old school in nature, where I think this type of gimmick could actually get over, and I would kind of like to see him. I don't know who else I'd add to it, but I think you need at least three or four people to make it work. But those two, I think, would be nice little corner pieces. And I could get behind that. And here they do. You're right. They had just a nice little fun match. Nothing blow away. And again, Cutshaw's finisher just looks fantastic. And I thought these guys worked well together. Then we got an Andrews promo. What you make of this?
Andrews always. Oh, there's a Stevie Fierce promo before it that it was a.
Oh, was fun. There? Okay.
And then the Eric Andrews promo was fantastic. The guy just, he's got his character down pat. You buy into him completely. He's this scuzzy sleazeball, backwoods from, you know, from the, I don't even know, Appalachian Trail. But he's just so shitty, and I love it. The guy is just oozes just disdain and unlikability
other. I know. I totally agree. I mean, he plays his character really well, and I really enjoy his promos and stuff. Then we got the females. I did not write their names down. Do you got them?
Yeah, Aspen Rose and Jessica Troy, who I think Troy is either from the UK or from Australia.
What'd you make of it?
I thought it was good. I thought that Troy, midway through the match, is very clearly supposed to be the underdog babyface, with Rose going slightly heel. And I thought that it affected my ability to buy into that because of Troy early on playing a little bit too cocky, kind of working to the crowd to get, you know, adulation. And not in the babyface clap your hands, hey, is everyone having fun kind of way, but in the, like, oh, I'm so great way. And I think if you're going to try to be clean-cut, plucky underdog babyface, especially against someone like Aspen Rhodes, who's so undersized, that you're going to need to really work that up and be about as pure babyface as you can for it to work. The match itself, I mean, there was some good back and forth. I thought Rose did a really good job of working in a few really nice choice cutoffs and counters when she could. Big strikes to change momentum. And then eventually gets put away with the perfect plex, giving Troy the win. I think that because Rose's cutoffs and counters looked so good, it helped to, because she got enough, I think it helped add some equity to the, which is, hey, I haven't said that in a while, to add some equity to the win for Troy to make her look like a big deal coming out of this match. So I think that they did a good job executing what they were trying to execute here.
Yeah, it looked like they were getting a little blown up. And they looked a little tired in the ring. But yeah, overall, it was solid stuff. And then we get, who is this? I can't even read my writing. Who's the promo we get here?
I don't know his name, but he's the guy who came from Japan for the Weaver Cup.
Oh, yeah, Utamaro. That's it. Utamaro. Yeah. Okay.
That's a promo in Japanese.
Right, and then we get Percy Davis and Frankie the Filmmaker promo. What you make of that?
I don't know what to think of Percy Davis, honestly. It's really hard for me to get into him so far. He kind of makes me think of like a less naturally likable Chuck Taylor sometimes.
Okay.
And so I'm just not super into him yet. Them as a tag team, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see, but I guess it couldn't be worse than where Percy Davis is right now in CWF, where he's kind of just a job guy.
Exactly. And then we got the Mike Moretti promo, and I like this one. I liked it. It wasn't as totally wacky as like his last one, but here he kind of had it. You know, he had something about him I liked. I don't know what it was. I don't know what it was, and I can't even put my finger on it. But something about him made me interested about him. Care about him.
Yeah, I think he did a really good job staying on point, but also playing this kind of maniacal, crazy character. He kept going back to Lucas Calhoun, bringing him up. So, you know, he's referencing the match. So, that's the money of the promo, making you want to see the match, talking about the match, talking up the match. So, you know, I'll give him that. I think it, in some ways, when you say he's got it, it's kind of that old school flair that I think is missing in some ways in promos now, where it always comes back to the money. It comes back to what's the point of the promo, trying to talk people into the building for the match. And that's, he kind of stayed on point for that. He talked about himself. He's going to make himself important. He's going to make Australia important. But he always stayed focused on the match and the Weaver Cup, and that you're going to want to come see him fight. So I think he did a really good job, honestly.
Yeah, and then we get to the main event, which is the Dawsons and Kane Justice and Eric Andrews versus Smith Garrett, Chet Sterling, Dirty Daddy, and Snooty Fox. And I really enjoyed this a lot. I gave it 4 stars. I enjoyed how they're teasing problems with Justice and the rest of his team right off the bat. Love Kane and Garrett's grappling early on. We see Dirty Daddy throws a really beautiful-looking palm strike. Love the face shine in this. Kane's leg kick to set up the tag looked absolutely wicked. I thought we saw some good teamwork by Fox and Daddy. I loved the story of all of this, what was going on. Loved how the Dawsons set up the heat on Sterling. I thought Sterling's face and peril work was absolutely fantastic. The match starts breaking down, and I love how Kane causes problems between Garrett and Sterling. And the finish I thought was absolutely fantastic. Again, we've said this all the time about CWF Mid-Atlantic, is even when you don't have Trevor Lee there, they have a way of presenting their main event as a big deal. And here, this, again, got over huge as a big, big freaking deal. And I thought it was absolutely fantastic. And they weaved so much storytelling in it. And they told a bunch of character beats. I thought it was just tremendous what they did there. What you made. And also, I thought it was awesome that we can get a 8-man tag that doesn't turn into a spot fest. And it was all direct. It was all driven by storytelling, which I thought was fantastic, because it seems like wrestlers are now, a lot of days, will cheapen out and just go and do their athletic prowess and their ooh and ahs and negate the story here. And what we got was a lot of advancement on what we could go going forward. I thought it was tremendous.
Yeah, I agree with you in every way. I think when it did break down, it broke down into a brawl, and it fit the story and the narrative of what was going on in the match at the time, which was perfect. As you said, it didn't just break down at times into devolving into spots for the sake of spots, which is super impressive. Another thing, I mean, it's an 8-man tag with a lot of different guys, a lot of different moving parts, and they made sure that a lot of times matches like these, big multi-man matches, are put together to protect and kind of isolate certain things, not giving away matchups. But this match, I mean, you really got a little bit of everything throughout the match. I think Kane got in there with almost everyone. Dawson's worked a little bit of heat on Snooty, and then a little bit of heat on Chet as well. So, I mean, they kind of went all over the place. I thought that was great that they didn't essentially like have no matchup get featured at least a little bit here, which I thought was really interesting, because you got these 8 men who are all in really different spots and different places in their career. Loved the narrative about Kane should have just tapped out to a handshake early on, but he didn't, because, you know, he's not gonna follow that, because he's just hot-headed. Even if his team is telling him just take the pin, just take the loss, it's not gonna happen, because he wants to win. The miscommunication at the beginning on the heel team is teased to then show at the end. There's a little feign of miscommunication, as it seems that Chet thinks that there's a possibility that Garrett blocked him from taking the pin, when that's not really what happened. It was Andrews who blocked the pin, or no, it was Kane who messed up the pin that then led to Andrews getting the pin. I love that as well, because it comes back. Andrews was the one who kind of gave the most shit to Kane, and Kane was the one who kind of not only stole a page from Andrew's book, he also helped set him up to be the one who gets the win. So it just kind of shows that the heels stayed completely aligned, while the faces started to get a little frayed at the edges after teasing that in the beginning. And everything you said, I also agree with. I mean, then the finish and the post-match with Chet starting a kind of... Or no, actually, Cutshaw comes out first. He chases Andrews all the way out of the building, which is very interesting, as, you know, he's challenging the heel there, and his character comes across kind of as a heel, but he comes across like a totally opposite heel who wants to fight first and ask questions later, when Andrews is the one who'd rather run. So you can kind of make that dynamic work and have it still be heel versus heel. So I like that. And then the post-match promo with Chet talking about how he's going to go after LaRue, who tries to jump him, and you know, essentially says, I'm in the Weaver Cup, and I'm especially in the Weaver Cup because I want to get a piece of your ass, telling Logan that, you know, he's coming after him in the Weaver Cup. And I really enjoyed this main event. I really enjoyed this episode quite a bit. I think they did a good job kind of telling stories, and afterwards you didn't feel like you missed anything, but you're still left wanting more, which is just kind of the perfect feeling to have at the end of a wrestling show.
Did you give a match a star rating?
Oh, yeah, I'd probably give the main event 3.75, maybe 4 star. I mean, I thought it was great.
Yeah, and I'm with you. I love the Sterling promo. I love the ending to the show. Really put a nice exclamation point on the show. Yeah, again, yeah, excellent show. These guys, man, week to week, they're about as consistent of a promotion as it gets, and it's just tremendous. Just tremendous storytelling, good booking, good announcing, good production value, and they have a talent roster that's just really deep, and they're all smart. Seems like they really are just smart workers, you know. It's good stuff overall. On that note, why don't we take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk some NXT.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we offer those to you on 3 great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows plus others available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And we are back. We're back looking at NXT. And we open up, we get Ember Moon versus Ruby Riott, man. What you make of this?
Oh, the opening up with Ruby Riott. I did like the promo in the beginning, hyping up the main event before the match. I thought they did a good job there, just kind of teasing what's happening on the show. I like that because you kind of miss that in a lot of wrestling anymore, like kind of getting you excited for something, even if it is happening just later on the same show. I liked the beginning of this match with them kind of teasing, trading off quick pinfalls. You know, they really were flawless there, super crisp back and forth. I liked them kind of doing, they're kind of doing the standoff spots, but in a more realistic and natural way instead of kind of the Will Ospreay ricochet backflip pose way. I mean, they're countering spots and landing on their feet and then kind of just looking at each other. You know what I mean? They're not posing and it's not as fake. Yeah. So I did like that. After that, they kind of settle into an actual match with it kind of slowing down and some headlocks and stuff like that, which I, you know, obviously, realistically, it's a fight. That's what's going to happen. I liked the big senton from Ruby Riott as a near fall. Super, I thought that was pretty believable. I like Riott cutting off Moon the first time she's going up for the Eclipse. And then after that, Moon strings together some big, nice, crisp-looking offense. Eventually does hit the Eclipse. I thought, at times this felt like an exhibition of, like, what cool spots can we do, and didn't have a lot of focus. But overall, I mean, the girls are both super athletic and can execute some great moves, and Ruby Riott can sell really well, so it adds in some drama. But I think the match could have used a little bit more narrative and a little bit more structure instead of trying to just kind of base itself off of that fact, especially because Ruby was on offense so much that I don't think that there was a lot of extra drama to the match based around her selling. And I don't think that Ember, she's not a bad seller, but I don't think she's anywhere near as dynamic of a seller.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. And it felt, I don't know, it felt like they were trying to have like a big, big grand match. And they kind of were a little skimpy on some of the basics and stuff. But overall, it was an entertaining match. Then we got Ono and Itami, and pretty much they set up an angle. You know, it's just they're just furthering their angle for later on. You know, really nothing really to it. But I guess it's just another piece of business. What about you? Any thoughts on it?
I'm not super excited about this feud yet, and I'm hoping that they get me there continuing, because it's two guys that I do really like, but as of right now, I'm just, I don't know about you, but I'm not, like, super excited about this matchup.
Nah, it's, you know, I think Chris Hero hasn't, like, lit the world on fire since he's come back. I don't blame him. I just think he just hasn't been put in the position to have kick-ass matches. And then we got a Street Profit vignette. You know, I don't really care about these guys yet, but we'll see. What about you?
Yeah, I'm hoping that they do something decent with these guys. They seem like they could be a nice addition to the tag team division right now that's a little bit dead. But, I mean, what do we have to go off of? There's not much to go off of yet.
Yeah, exactly. And then we got Oney Lorcan versus Danny Burch. And again, Lorcan is establishing himself as one of the best TV workers in the company. But we got more blood here. I thought this was a fun, hard-hitting match. And afterwards, Burch wants a rematch. I'm all in on that because it was hard-hitting. But do you think Lorcan's going to end up getting heat because he ends up busting all these guys up? We're getting a lot of hard-way blood with him in the matches.
Yeah, I don't...
He's the common guy. I mean, we have seen it here. We saw it with Otami. We saw it with Drew McIntyre, right? Those are the three off the top of my head I was able to name.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what's going on, if he's being told to or allowed to do this. It's kind of... I said it, I think, on the first time with Drew, and then continuing along, it keeps happening, and I'm just... Is he, like, the one guy who's being allowed to just get blood and go fucking crazy all the time? It's just... It's kind of nuts so far, but I am a little bit, again, I'm with you, I'm a little bit concerned that he's going to get in trouble for it, because nobody else seems to be allowed to work so stiff.
I totally agree. But do you think he's becoming, do you think he's one of the best television workers they have in the company right now?
I am part of a group of people. We primarily conversate on the Wrestling with Words Slack chat, who think that Oney Lorcan is probably one of the best workers on the planet and has been for a while. And yeah, he is just getting better and better with the matches that he gets to show off here.
Yeah, now he's just having the opportunity to do sprints as opposed to having 15, 20-minute hard-hitting battles with, like, a Timothy Thatcher, as opposed to, you know, it's just different.
Yeah, totally different dynamic, and it makes him stand out even bigger on NXT because he is the only guy having these matches, so it does make it feel like a big deal.
Yep, and then we get No Way Jose versus Pannoni. What'd you make of this?
This was a weird one to me because it felt like they're trying to cash in on Cesar and that win that he got off of Almas, and they do somewhat, but then, I mean, it feels like he just gets knocked out pretty easily after looking pretty good throughout the match, so there it feels like they're a little bit hot and cold, or not hot and cold, but they're kind of one foot in, one foot out on Benoni right now, and they haven't quite committed to him just yet, which you understand because he's still new and pretty green, but we'll see where they go from here. I don't necessarily know what I think about the guy yet. I don't know if he's ready for it. Jose looks great. I don't know what the fuck they're doing with the guy. It seems like they have no focus with him, and they don't know what to do with him, which is really interesting because he seems like one of those five-tool player types, you know?
And I really thought him and Rich Swann, when they were tagging up, I thought that was a tag team that had legs and could have done something on the main roster, because if they felt over, they felt different enough. Swan could play the face in peril while No Way Jose could get the hot tag, and they could have fun doing vignettes, and where they were good enough where they could work in a tag team program, but then they're goofy enough where they can have fun underneath skits and stuff. I really truly think they missed out when they had these guys in the Dusty Rhodes tournament, and they it was one of those things where they weren't planning on it getting over, or they didn't realize how awesome it was going to be. And they, you know, of course they had different plans and they had a different idea of where these guys were going. And now we don't get them together. And now kind of both guys are floundering. I thought they were better together than they were separate.
Yeah. And especially with Enzo and Kaz now broken up. I mean, these guys fit that role perfectly.
Yeah. But they're definitely not on Vince's radar, because I don't think Vince watches too much NXT, and so, and obviously, it's an act that's not together, so they have zero buzz in the office, so it really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I thought they missed the ball there, and I enjoyed this. I enjoyed the match. I liked the post-match with Almas after Benoni and challenging No Way Jose. It just feels like it all feels like a big step down for everybody. Seeing Almas was a hot heel a couple months ago, and now he's like floundering and a losing streak and party gimmick, and No Way Jose has been off and on and off TV constantly, with getting really, once he gets momentum, he disappears for a while and we don't know what's going on. Pinoni's getting a bone throw to him type of push, where it's a push, but it's not really a push. It's a push as like, hey, you're a top and top level jobber, but you're not going anywhere, a type of thing. And him losing this quickly to No Way Jose, he gets positioned back to where he was, which was enhancement talent. So I thought overall for everybody involved, I don't think anybody came out of this looking better than they did coming into it.
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, we talked about it earlier with that four-way match making everyone look like a big deal coming out of it, and this was the opposite. I mean, this one singles match seemed to devalue three acts all at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just terrible. We get the big match, which is Drew McIntyre versus Killian Dane, the Battle of Undefeateds. I mean, let me talk about it first. I mean, obviously, I don't think Killian Dane was pushed hard enough to be battling out for the number one spot. And you could kind of sell, and then putting these together, they're trying to build it up like it was a big angle, but they've had that one angle. And I felt, who was the other guy? Alexander Wolf, right?
Yeah, it's Dane and Alexander Wolf.
And I felt Alexander Wolf got more over out of the angle than Killian Dane did. What about you?
Yeah, for sure.
McIntyre. Yeah, I thought Wolf had the mannerisms and the character work so much better than Killian Dane, where Killian Dane came across as he also ran. Well, it should have been him being the major ass kicker and getting the heat in the angle, but it ended up being Wolf who outperformed him in the angle.
Yeah, no, and I think Wolf is putting it together. He's figuring stuff out, and Dane, we both talked about it. Dane doesn't feel like he should be in the contention for the title match at all. I don't know. Do you want me to kind of talk about this match somewhat?
In a little minute, but then you're right. But you hit the head right on the head. And the crowd responded like they did not believe Killian Dane had a snowball's chance in hell. And then they, towards the end, they go to those one counts. And the crowd just isn't buying into it at all. Where they, I think the wrestlers are expecting them to get a huge reaction. And they got, I mean, lukewarm at best. And honestly, like we talked a few weeks ago where I said the Roddy Strong program, I didn't think the Drew McIntyre program could follow up. And where I thought Roddy's program with Rude was so, it was much more deserving and more, it was so much just, it was too good to be just a TV program. And then Mac has to follow that. And well, it's not even on near the level the Roddy Strong feud was with Rude. And this is the guy coming in headlining. Thank God he had some momentum because the booking and the creative has not helped him out at all. But now, why don't you talk about the match and all the other things surrounding it?
So, yeah, I mean, I'm with you pretty much on everything there when it comes to the way that he's been booked, everything revolving kind of the Sanity Act and...
And then, you know what? I mean, the thing is, with Drew Mack, he actually looked super strong going into this program. But once he got to the program, the creative, it just hasn't been very creative.
No, and this, I mean, it's I don't even know if it's a program or what it is, because this felt like, I mean, I kind of get what they were going for, but this didn't feel like this is setting up anything else. So it's, I don't know why they went out of their way to have Sanity in an extra, you know, in an extra angle attacking him when the match was already set up, so you could just go with, like, Regal set up the match because they're both undefeated. You didn't need to try to add any more depth to it, especially because this match didn't feel like it's
big.
Going longer. It didn't feel like there needs to be more to this. It felt like a one-and-done match. Now Drew goes on to the title. But yeah, the match didn't feel big, that's for damn sure. It felt like way too quickly, without earning it, they tried to start making it feel like it was a big hoss fight, like war, that they've just been beating the shit out of it. And I was like, you haven't done jack yet at this point. This match is barely starting and you're acting like it's this huge war brawl that you guys are just taking each other to the limits.
And you know what? It's even funny is that they did the same thing again where Orny Lorcan, I felt, worked a lot stiffer of a match than the main event, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And Oney Lorcan's been doing that for weeks now, where he's outshining everything else that's supposed to be a big deal on the show, just because he's so damn good. But yeah, then the finish was fucking gratuitous, and I don't think it did what they wanted to do. Dane got his ass kicked, kept getting his ass kicked. Then he gets hit with one finisher, the old finisher, the Future Shock. He kicks out at one. I think you're supposed to think that that's a big fucking deal, but then Drew just keeps going. He hits him with the Claymore. He kind of shakes it off and gets up. Another Claymore and he's down. And I didn't leave it thinking, oh, that Killian Dane, he's so indestructible, because he just kept getting hit. Like, sure, he kicked out. Sure, he took it, but he didn't do anything with it. So, like, it's not impressive to me that he can just take getting beat up a lot. I need to see he can take it, and then he comes back. All he did was just get put down slowly as Drew is just destroying him. I think it really missed the mark on trying to get a guy over. I think it doesn't make Dane look strong. It doesn't make Drew look strong. And I just thought, yeah, I think that it was just too much for what they were trying to push. The narrative they were trying to push just didn't get achieved because... I don't think that Dane was the guy for this spot.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and it left flat, and both guys look worse coming out of this. That's never good. So we've seen back to back segments where people went in and they came out worse out of the program. You know.
Exactly. It's a big problem when it's seeming like NXT just doesn't know how to get guys over, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they were on fire for a while, then they hit a couple of hiccups, and here, this is another thumbs in the middle show for me, where it felt like, man, they just screwed this up. And in the past, they'd hit home runs on a lot of this stuff, and here it wasn't very creative.
No, it was not, and it feels bad because they've been working really hard and trying to make, you know, everything happen for them. But right now it's just in a weird lull that I just can't get super behind.
Totally agree. Why don't we take a break here? And then when we come back, we'll talk all about the G1.
Coming soon from the creative minds of the Place to Be Nation Pop Network. The audio adaptation that no one was asking for, but everyone deserved. Place to Be Nation Pop Comic Book Theater presents Watchmen, an audio feast for your ears. Thrill to the exploits of the comedian.
These are demons! It's an intergalactic invasion into this space through people. They have sexual rituals, some of the most ancient Egyptian rituals, where they believe they are possessed by entities, space aliens.
Silk Spectre.
Good. Hey, licking your finger, it's like licking a battery. It's all sort of...
Night Owl.
Well, you know how it goes. Sometimes I come down here and sit around a little bit, think about the times when we were making the towns, doing the drugs, fucking the rats.
Dr. Manhattan.
Clearly, you don't really care about what stimulates me.
Ozymandias.
Puta, the Soviets, Vietnam, anyone? Mila Jovovich?
And Rorschach.
But what it doesn't change is the fact, and this is something we can all agree on, that all of the whores and politicians will look up and they'll shout, "Save us, JR!" And I'll look down and I'll whisper, "Ma."
You won't believe your ears. You won't believe the dark places your imagination will take you. Featuring cameos from some of your PTBN favorites.
Baby, that's quite a drop, I said.
Ugh, they're just paying me to handle monsters in outer space? No.
Maybe it was a couple of guys and they overpowered him.
He cometh up and swerve, cut down like a flower.
Fly me to the moon, let me fuck amongst my star. Oh, I guess Dr. Osterman finally arrived.
You remember Skimitka? It's Watchmen. The greatest graphic novel of all time, as you've never heard it before. Transformed into the most self-referential collection of in-jokes on this or any other medium. Only from the hard-traveling fanboys and Place to Be Nation Pop.
And we are back, and we're talking G1. We have night one, night two, and night three of watch so far, and we're going to go right into it. We open up at G1 night one, and we open up with Yoshihashi versus Nuji Nagata. This is Nagata's last run in the G1. This is Yoshihashi's second appearance. He opened a lot of eyes last year, and as in, hey, this guy's a pretty good worker. And here... we got a good match. It was good, hard hitting. Crowd was totally into it. There were some great near submissions. Just really good stuff, you know. I gave it 3.5 stars, and I thought both guys looked pretty good here. What about you, man?
I was at 3 stars on this one. I agree with you. I think it was an interesting way to start out the tournament. I thought that it really felt like they gave them a lot of time, which I didn't expect. Nice back and forth. Nagata's kicks and everything is looking good. Nagata is really, I mean, this match, and then we'll talk about his other match, he's really bringing it for his last tournament. Really impressive there. Yoshihashi, as you said, a guy who's coming through strong and really putting it together to be a guy who can start to get to that upper mid-card level, maybe even to the top. I don't necessarily know that he'll ever be an IWGP champion, but I think he could do an Intercontinental title reign at some point. So yeah, I'm with you. Pretty good stuff. Like I said, 3 stars. interesting. Yoshihashi goes for kind of a made in Japan, but he hits it a little bit differently here. More of a vertical suplex into the driver than the pup handle slam there. But I thought this was pretty good stuff.
Yeah, and then we get that leads us into Makabe and Bad Luck Fale. What you make of it, brother?
On paper, this is my least appealing matchup, I think, of the tournament, probably. Throw some punches early. They brawl around the ring. Fale's choking Makabe with the chain. Go back into the crowd. I mean, it's exactly kind of what you expect from these two. Makabe's comeback is just what it is. It's Makabe. And then the finish was a little weird with Fale catching Makabe, coming down from the knee drop by the throat to hit the grenade. I never really got super into it. The crowd was reacting pretty strong. They liked the two big guys kind of brawling it out, but for me it was somewhat uninspired, nothing special. Didn't feel like either guy's trying to really turn it up, and they didn't have a lot of time even to do much anyways. I gave it 2 stars.
Yeah, I went 2.25, and that's I'm kind of with you. It was just there for me. Nothing offensively bad, but nothing that I'm going to remember in the next day or two. And that leads us into Ishii versus Goto. And I really like this match. I give it 4.25 stars. These guys' styles I thought meshed really well. It was a hard-hitting fight. Big feel fight to it. Built well to the bumps. A lot of this style I'm not a fan of, but these guys made me buy into it. I would love a night one story of two guys just absolutely killing each other, where they end up losing all their other matches because they were spent by having one big epic battle. I think that'd be a fun story to tell. But man, it was just a hard hitting. Throwback to yesteryear. I give it 4.25, and I'm not a big fan. I like both guys, but I'm not a huge fan of either one of them. But they made me buy into this style that I'm not even a huge fan of. But because of how they worked it and sold some of the stuff, they made me believe into this style, and I really enjoyed it. What'd you make of the match?
Yeah, I'm pretty much right there with you. And I think part of it, too, that made this match work was it felt like they drew some stuff back from kind of how excessively kind of pushing the limits they had gotten.
Yep.
I loved the opening because it's the fast pace, shoulder blocking off of each other, boom, boom, boom. It's kind of like the opening from that G1, the first G1 match between Ishii and Shibata, but instead of kind of being ridiculous with the opening match as a big charging kick to the head, it's shoulder block, so it's still wrestling, and it's not trying to be something other than wrestling, which I think was kind of important in this match, is that it seems like they're bringing stuff back to some semblance of sanity and not pushing the limits so far with just killing each other, essentially. And I think it probably has something to do with Shibata. I mean, I can't imagine that they're not in some ways a little bit concerned with what happened with him, that they're going to tone some stuff back. And I think that led to a lot of really good stuff with them kind of milking drama, teasing suplexes, doing big lariat offs when at other times that might have been just straight punches to the head or even like unprotected headbutts and chops to the throat and stuff. Instead, they're just using lariats, which I think works really well to convey a very similar kind of concept of a rough fight, but it doesn't necessarily go over the top where it's unbelievable in the context of a wrestling match that these guys would be able to do this to each other. The finish I thought was super hot as they just are really shoving each other and showing like kind of what makes them look like a big deal and that they could go on to the tournament. I had actually the same reaction as you, that I felt like coming out of this, they felt like they really essentially killed each other in the first round. And now they're pretty much fucked going forward. And it's just kind of the luck of the draw that they got each other on the first night, because now they're both going to be really spent. And if they lose, you know, the next match and maybe a match after that because they're just so beat up, it could affect the entire tournament for them coming out of it.
Exactly. What'd you make of Tanahashi?
I don't know if I gave my star rating, 3.75.
Oh, no. All right, cool. Wait, what about Tanahashi and the man, Zack Sabre Jr.?
I loved this. I liked that they started out grappling. I love Tanahashi taking a look at Desperado on the floor and just kind of making it known that he's got his eye on him. I loved that. I love that Tanahashi doesn't give anything to Zack, and it's fucking perfect. So many of these guys let Zack kind of guzzle them up on the indies because he's good at grappling and they don't know how to counter and how to keep up with him, so they just let him transition from move to move to move, and it looks, I hate to say it, but it looks fake. And Tanahashi is so committed to realism in wrestling. I mean, that's why he says he hates the idea of shaking hands before a match like they do in ROH, because it's not real.
Right.
He does that here. He puts up a fight for everything that Zack does. He's constantly fighting. He's not just letting Zack show off all of his cool arm locks. He's fighting with him the whole way through. It's part of why Hiro was such a great competitor for Zack, as he also would fight him the whole way through and didn't just give up to everything Zack wanted to do. So I loved that a lot from him. The focus on the arm. Zack's even hitting the penalty kick at the arm, which I love. Tanahashi gets like almost a comeback. He doesn't even really get a comeback, because Zack is just so focused and so fucking up this arm. It's the worst case scenario for Tanahashi as well, because he's in there with a guy who knows all these nasty arm locks, and he's the master of the arm bar, and he's got the bad arm. And then, yeah, you come into the finish, and Zack, after having worked over the arm the whole way, he's got this nasty arm bar as he just slowly rips and pulls down the sleeve. He's cranking on it as hard as he can and just ripping the ligaments and the tendons, and he just takes him out, and Tanahashi taps out. You got instantly Zack's got credibility for the rest of the tournament. Instantly, Tanahashi's story of the arm is obviously set, and I'm like, this A block is fucking amazing. They're telling great stories. They're doing prolonged injury angles from night one with this, and then back-to-back with the next match is another one where they're doing the same thing. I'm just like, God, thank you. This A-block is phenomenal storytelling and just taking such advantage of the guys that they have in it. And, I mean,
For variety. Yeah. I mean, it's night one here. You got a slobber knocker. You got a technical match. You got the storytelling with, like, Naito, and we'll get to it later with Naito and Ibushi, where you had all the storytelling, but it also has all the big bells and whistles of a New Japan main event, you know, with all the spamming of near falls and stuff. And then you had the Nagata, the legend, making his last run. I mean, it was a very, very varied... I'd be hard-pressed to find a more... show that offered so much more, offered this much variety anywhere in the world after this. I mean, you had everything you could want in a wrestling match. This was the epitome of the three-ring circus.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, the Zack and Tanahashi match, I gave 4 stars. And I agree with you and every sane individual on the planet. Zack Sabre Jr., I think, is beating back any possible naysayers. I think he's really showing that he's not a flash in the pan. He's just a guy with some buzz. As he's coming into New Japan and instantly feeling on the level, and he's instantly getting to show off in the G1 as a possible big-time threat in the company.
Yeah, I after watching last weekend of him in Evolve, where I thought I loved both his matches there, and then his first 2 nights of the G1, he's instantly moved up as my number one wrestler of the year. I mentioned this on I did a show with Scott and Nate Milton, and that's what I said. I didn't think Sabre Jr., I think Scott was thinking Sabre Jr. might go and win the G1 or finish really high.
Wanted to steal a page from the Place to Be Nation podcast's playbook here, but I had to do it in post. So just so you know, Scott, when it comes to Zack Sabre Jr. winning the G1, he's got
no chance! No chance at all!
I still don't think he's going to finish super high, but I can see him as a top 4 or 5 point guy, but I don't see him as like one of the top 3 point guys in the tournament. But this is a tournament where here he could really light it up. And right here, it was great. 4.25-star match for me. I liked right off the bat, it kind of has this feel of like Tully versus Steamboat from Starrcade 84, where Tanahashi's turning his body angle-wise to make it harder for Zack to get his arm. And first Zach starts on the leg to start, but that's just a ruse to suck Ta-Nehisi in. He uses that leg to get to the arm, which I loved. And then Zach is just all over that arm, and Ta-Nehisi's just selling, and he's getting hope spots here and there, getting some flashes. Then Zach again is just destroying that bad arm. And then Zach nails him with this nasty lifter, European forearm. Ta-Nehisi's just really great fighting underneath, and Ta-Nehisi's comebacks were armed at Zach's leg. I love the high flow, high five flow counter. A really good stuff. 4.25, like I said. We just talked about Zach, but let's look at Ta-Nehisi. We saw this match, and then later on we'll talk about his match with Folly. I'm kind of liking the stripped-down Ta-Nehisi where he doesn't have all his tools. But what we get out of him is, A, he's an incredible seller. B, he's super over. And he has really great timing on his comebacks. And so he's able to make everything work, especially like with the Zack Sabre Jr. match here. Zach was driving the narrative, but man, I thought Ta-Nehisi was fantastic as this stripped down version of Ta-Nehisi where I enjoyed where he doesn't have all his athletic tools with him and he's able to focus more on the storytelling. And I thought he was absolutely fantastic here.
I completely agree with you, and it's actually kind of a point that I've somewhat made before talking about Ta-Nehisi matches, and I think it was either last G1 or possibly the one before, but it was the match with Goto where I talked about how he stripped everything down, but he still made sure to have a match that got the crowd completely involved. And he just knows how to work the drama and work to the level that he needs to when he has to. I think that he's one of these guys, though, that has a little bit of that Ric Flair... he has a little bit of that Ric Flair, I have to hit all the stuff when he can. Yeah. And so he likes to go a little bit too over the top when he knows that he can and when he thinks that it's right. But realistically, sometimes he's better off with a match like this, especially for guys like me and you, because we actually really enjoy the bare bones kind of storytelling side of Ta-Nehisi, where I think that he can... I mean, he has just about as good psychology as anybody else in... Not just in wrestling now, but probably in the history of wrestling.
And the other thing I like is I compare him to, I feel like he's like, well, the way he is, because of his tools kind of being, his athleticism has kind of been taken out because of the injury, but he's still able to, you know, has great psychology, is he reminds me of an over Juice Robinson, you know? I'm being like super over. I mean, Juice is over, but not at like the Ta-Nehisi level. But he's working like he's Juice Robinson, but with the equity, like of you like to say, of being Ta-Nehisi. You know?
Yeah. No. Exactly. He's that plucky underdog babyface who can just hit basic stuff, and the crowd just loves everything he does.
And now we move into Naito versus Ibushi. Kota Ibushi, Naito. Wow, what a match. I gave it 4 3/4. I love Naito's after the neck. Selling the groundwork for Destino. A big neck breaker on the ring skirt. Loving Naito's heat segment here. Ibushi selling the neck really well. A cravat, but Naito continues to work the neck and stuff. Another great spot. Ibushi with an explosive comeback. Super reverse Rana was absolutely nuts. Ibushi with the human lawn dart toss into the corner. Just over the top rope German. Again, another nutty spot. Second row pile driver by Ibushi. I will say this had some spamming, definitely some spamming of moves, but the crux of the matter was they told a great story about the neck and Ibushi going after the neck. And I mean, Naito going after the neck and Ibushi with great comebacks and explosiveness. And so I think that's the thing. I think this fits, but I think this is a match where the guys who are into big moves will love it because there's a shitload of big moves. I think you'll love it. Like for me, because of the storytelling, and then you can even combine the two with great storytelling and all the bells and whistles, and it really makes a special match. I was blown away by it, and I'm not a guy who needs big moves to make a match because I could care less. It's, to me, it's about the storytelling, but to a lot of people, the big moves matter a lot more than me. But when you're able to combine the two, I think you're able to, if you're able to please both your audiences like that, I think you've done something right, and I thought they hit it out of the park here. What about you?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I think my only complaint about the match, and this is off my first viewing, so I think I need to go back. I'm giving it 4.25. I think it's in that match of the year talk, and I'm definitely, when I put something at 4.25, that means I'm going to definitely give it another viewing to decide, but my biggest issue with the match was that I felt like Naito's neck work, especially the neck breaker on the apron, was too damn vicious and too damn good for me to believe Ibushi coming back the way he did. I mean, when he
was
going...
That's a fair argument.
When he was going for the first Destino, I was like, okay, it's over. Because he had just killed this guy. And again, the biggest spot for me is that neckbreaker on the apron. I mean, Ibushi takes it all on his neck. The guy in storyline in New Japan has missed like over a year of wrestling in New Japan because of his neck. And he takes a neckbreaker right on the apron, all completely on his neck. And I just can't believe him getting back. I mean, his selling was great from then on. Naito was vicious and nasty on the neck. I couldn't believe it. When he went for the first Destino, I really thought that was going to be it. And then having more after that really felt superfluous. Now, that's when stuff kind of started getting insane, and there was some really great spots and fighting back, and Ibushi just... I mean, like, you talked about the Super Rana and the Spring Up German and everything. It's just nutty. So, yeah, I mean, the only reason why I don't even have this higher is just because I thought that was just too much that early in the match to believe that Ibushi could then come back even later on and even put up a fight. That said, I agree with everything else you said. I mean, this match had a little something for everyone.
Yeah. Let's talk about the announcing real quick. I feel Don Callis has gotten better each and every show he's done. And it feels like he's getting more and more familiar with the talent. I'm really liking his role where he's a Bullet Club fanboy, but not like, not as obnoxious like Steve Corino was. It's a lot more low-keyed, but it's there. So I like his combative nature with Kevin Kelly, and I really think they have really good chemistry. And I really thought these guys were much better than the Jim Ross, Josh Barnett team. What were your thoughts here on the commentating?
So I'm going to admit, not by choice, but just because of it kind of happening, I did watch all of this in the Japanese commentary.
Okay, fair enough.
That said, I listened to the English as well on different shows, and I agree with you. I think that Callis and Kelly have become one of the better commentary teams in wrestling right now. So yeah, I think that I much prefer them. I think Don Callis, as he's gotten more familiar with the product, just keeps getting better. It's kind of funny to think about that, though, because if you go back to listen to old ECW commentary, Joey Styles doesn't, you know, hold up for as good as he is. I wonder if going back to listening to Don Callis and ECW, if maybe he does. I don't know. It'd be an interesting thing to check out.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, yeah, Callis, when we first started, I was like, yeah, he got it because he's friends with Kenny. I don't think that anymore. He's improved so much where I think he's one of the better color guys out there. He's definitely, I think I have him right under, he's definitely one of the top three with Cecil and Corey Graves. With that said, I was really impressed with especially with the call on there talking about and giving us the history of Kota Ibushi's neck. And so I enjoyed that when they're also putting that over in the match. But hey, let's shift over to easy thumbs up, right? On night one.
Oh,
on
those shows. Yeah, no question.
Very versatile. And then we shift on over to night two. And we open up with Kojima versus Juice Robinson. What you make of this?
I thought that, again, as we've talked so much about Juice, I mean, right here, he looked fantastic as a babyface. Crowd is super strong behind him. The crowd is also behind Kojima. So, I mean, this crowd was just electric for pretty much this whole match. They were really, really into everything. I liked Kojima in the beginning, thinking that his grappling experience is going to be enough to take over on Juice easily, but he doesn't. So then from there, he's hit, you know, big DDT, some Mongolian chops, then a DDT onto the apron, which is just nasty. And he's just stomping on Juice on the floor, and then I'm starting to think, oh, are they going to have Kojima kind of go heel here? Only to get cut off and whipped into the rail, shotgun dropkick into the rail, and Juice, I like that from there, after kind of just quickly whipping Kojima into the rail and dropkicking him so his back hits the rail. Then when they get back into the ring, Juice is kind of working over the back in the midsection a little bit, hitting the senton and strike attacks that are going towards the middle of him. I like that a lot. The crowd's getting fired up. Again, for both guys, the crowd's super into it. I love the cutoff of the elbow drop. I love the cutoff of Kojima dodging the cannonball. I thought they did a really good job of these guys kind of going back and forth. Huge spine buster just looked really great from Juice as Kojima was charging in for him. And then he hits the cannonball and he hits the big high cross off the top. And we talk about Juice being this kind of white meat babyface, and he's even got the old school babyface offense with the high cross off the top. I think that's just kind of great that he does that. I thought that they did a fantastic job here with the crowd. It's just wild for both guys. I mean, I couldn't believe how much the crowd was bought into both of them so much. I gave this 3.5 stars. I thought it was a really good way to make Juice look like, you know, on the level of Kojima, who's another guy that the crowd's just obviously super gaga for.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. I went 3.5 stars also. I liked the battling for position early in the match. Really dug Robinson's bump off the Mongolian chop. And sets up the hurts, dings his back. Robinson hits two drop kicks and tweaks the back. I enjoy that. Where he's on offense and he hurts his injured back and totally dug it. Like Juice receiving a spot in a revenge spot where he hits the spine buster and tries to hurt Kojima's back. Kojima transitions to focusing on Juice's neck. I thought it was really well done stuff. It told a good story. 3.5 stars. Yeah, Juice can work with anybody. And then we got Michael Elgin versus Tama Tonga. Now, here's the thing. A couple years back, last year when Tonga first made his first G1, people were saying now, yeah, this is going to be his launching pad. He's going to get over and he's going to show everyone what a great worker he is. I'm still waiting on that to happen. I think he's a very limited worker. He's never really shown much to me as a wrestler. He's cool. He has charisma about him, but between the ropes, he doesn't have anything to really write home about. And I felt Elgin did a good job here, but I didn't think Tama Tonga I mean that spider spot where he's like, you know, he's crawling on all fours. It's entertaining shtick, but he did that way. He relied on that almost to became a detriment by how much he was relying on that spot. I give it 2.5 stars, if you will. What you make of it?
2.75. I am pretty much with you. I liked some of the evasive tactics from Tama Tonga. I think that he used that really well for the narrative of the match.
But don't you feel he does that like every match?
He does it too much, you're right, but I think in the setting of this match it made sense and worked, but I totally get you that it's overdone. I liked Elgin showing off, you know, he really can kind of keep up with him speed, and obviously way outclasses him in power. I like that, you know, Elgin misses the slingshot splash, and that really is what sets up kind of the unraveling of him for the rest of the match as he then gets suplexed on the floor. And from that point, then Elgin's actually selling. I kind of love that because Elgin, he kind of made him earn Elgin even selling. So in the beginning, he doesn't really sell for anything, but then he gets suplexed on the floor, and then that kind of takes it out of him for the rest of the match. There was some stuff out of Tama Tonga. I mean, he's got situations where he's able to, like, he kicks out clean when he's right next to the rope. He's constantly kind of fighting back and looking somewhat valiant. And he was one of the most straight up heel guys in the Bullet Club. So I kind of hate that. I wish that he would take some time to do some rope breaks and a little bit of cheap stuff here and there, just to really keep that heel heat on him. I think that he jumps up into the body scissors and hits a DDT is one of the stupidest moves in wrestling, and that includes the lethal injection. I mean, it's such a dumb fucking move. And then, yeah, he's got the gun stun now, so that's becoming the, you know, it's just like Anderson and just like Randy Orton. It's, you get the out-of-nowhere counters to set up the move, so you get wins just because, like, hey, wouldn't it be cool if I did this and then I hit my move? Well, and then, of course, you have to get pinned after that. But yeah, the super Death Valley driver into the gunstun was cool, but realistically, I don't know if it necessarily should have been his win here. And like I said, 2 3/4, I was not super into the match.
Yeah, then we got Evil and Sonata. What'd you make of that?
I like that they just start out brawling on the floor again. I think if you do it right, it can work, and it makes sense with these guys because they're both in this heel group that's kind of their shtick. Lots of athletic stuff back and forth between them, lots of power moves. Evil has a good base for Sonata. Sonata can pretty much keep up with him, which I like a lot. I thought it was good that they're kind of playing off. They're both in LIJ, so they're both willing to cheat even on each other. They're kind of out-dicking and assholing each other, which is, that sounds weird. They're kind of out-cheating on each other. They're kind of trying to out-heal each other, which is good. I liked Evil going up top, and you're like, what the fuck is he going to do off the top? And he gets cut off by Sonata, but then he grabs a Dragon Sleeper, kind of stealing Sonata's move, but from a middle rope hung Dragon Sleeper. Then Sonata hits that big cutter from the middle rope to the floor, which is just kind of crazy spot for Evil to be taking, and kind of cool thing there. From there, I thought that, yeah, there's some really nice, like, familiarity counters back and forth, and I know I've been railing a little bit against them doing a little bit too much of that in New Japan, but I think that this is the setting where that works. These guys should know each other really well. They're in the same stable, they work together, they tag together. They should know counters for each other's moves, so I think that it works there. And as I said, you were talking about the Ibushi and Naito match as a match that kind of had some story and some spot fest. I think this was similar, but a lot more heavy on the spot fest and a lot more light on the story. But it was in the same vein where I think it could tick both boxes for you. If you're into either thing, you could be into this. That said, I mean, it's nowhere near as good. I gave it 3 1/4 star. I thought it looked good. I thought Evil didn't look necessarily anywhere near as good as he looked last year in the G1. But I thought Sonata looked pretty good going forward from here. So we'll see how both guys kind of balance out as they continue with the G1.
Yeah, I just thought it was just kind of there. Again, another 2.5 star match. Just I thought there was some wonky psychology spots. At times I was like, why are you doing this if you're making this type of comeback? It was just okay. But then we got Okada versus Yano. At this point, Yano has not bored me to tears yet. So we have that going for us. But it's still Yano. And I really don't think at any point in time you should have Okada or whoever your world champion is in a singles match with Yano. Okada is such a good worker. He's able to dumb down and do a dumb Yano match. But I don't want to see my ace of the company be put in that role. So I really don't think Yano should be in the tournament because that's the only time he gets a chance to wrestle the champion. And I just think it was just a failure of a move.
I am a little bit higher on it. What rating did you give it?
Oh, 2.5 stars.
Yeah, I gave it 2.5 then. We're right at the same spot. I thought it had some stuff to like. I thought that Yano did a good job. He was a less goofy. By the middle to end of the last G1, he really... You could tell he was kind of just phoning in spots. at times. And I think that here, he did a pretty good job of making it believable that this is the way Yano would work in a match against the champion where he's pretty much hopeless and winning, as opposed to just being like shtick for shtick's sake. So I enjoyed it somewhat, but I mean, again, I gave it 2.5 stars as well, so it's not like I thought it was amazing or anything.
True that. What do you think of the main event of Omega versus Minoru Suzuki?
I don't know if these guys gelled super well with each other. I mean, I still really enjoyed the match. I thought that Kenny Omega selling the knee towards the end was great. Obviously, Suzuki's legwork and submission work was fantastic. But I think that there was some stuff where you could definitely tell that Kenny was kind of trying to force Suzuki to work his kind of match and work some of his spots, and that's not necessarily the thing to do there in a situation like this. I did like the kind of like middle of the match breakdown with all of Suzuki-gun, and Omega's able to fight them all off until it's like kind of 3-on-1 and they have chairs. Owens comes out and just gets fucked by the 3 Suzuki-gun guys, and then Fale comes out to save the day for him. And it really harkens back. I said that I like Omega and Fale as a tag team, and I really like them having like this kind of relationship together with Fale being the one to save the day for him. He's got Omega's back as the leader of the Bullet Club. I like Omega, you know, Fale's not part of the elite with the Young Bucks and Omega, but he's got this relationship with Omega still that I think could be good and could be something that they take advantage of moving forward. That said, I mean, talking about Omega looking for stuff that he shouldn't be looking for because of who he's in there with, he goes for a reverse Rana on Suzuki, which is just stupid. It's like for a moment there, I think he forgot who he was wrestling, and he just like, he's so used to hitting that reverse Rana at that spot in the match that he just goes for it.
A little sloppy.
and Suzuki, I mean, he just doesn't take the bump right. He just takes a flat back bump because he can't do it. So, yeah, in that moment, it was like, oh, he must have forgot who he was in there with, or he was really, like I said, just trying to force something that wasn't going to work. I like that they pretty clearly gave the crowd what they wanted, which was the chance to just cheer for Kenny. They didn't really mess around with any kind of heel tactics or heel bullshit between them. It was Suzuki was the heel, Kenny was the face, and the crowd got to cheer for him pretty big. I love that when... I mean, it's very similar to the Okada match, but very toned down in that Suzuki had prolonged kind of torture moments in submission holds that maybe went longer than they should have. But I did then like that Suzuki really sold kind of a bewilderment on his face that he couldn't believe that Kenny wasn't giving it up. I gave this 3.75 star. Like I said, there were some sloppy spots. There were some problems here and there, but I think that Kenny really stuck to the narrative of the match with the leg selling. I loved, like I said, I actually liked the breakdown with the stables getting involved. I think Suzuki is just phenomenal at his character and always stays in character perfectly. And I really enjoyed the match, but I think that these guys are not natural opponents for each other.
I agree there. What'd you give it star-wise?
3.75.
Okay, that's what I own. I went 3.75 too. I liked the opening. I loved Suzuki kicking the guardrail to set up working over Omega's knee. Thought that was fantastic. Like Kalos putting over that red shoe is afraid of Suzuki. So when Suzuki brings out a chair and starts waffling Omega with it and doesn't get disqualified, well, it gives us a reason why, because Red Shoe's terrified of Suzuki. So at least it throws me a bone on to understand a spot that I normally would not understand, because it just should be an automatic disqualification. So it made sense to me. I liked Omega selling the leg, but he slugs it off when he had to go work into a spot. If you watch, he's selling, and then it's time to go on offense. His leg's perfectly fine. Then he's back to selling. I like to use it to the aching of he wants his cake and eat it too, where he should have just kept with the selling. He didn't need to transition into a oh my god spot, you know. just be consistent, man. Sell that leg. It won't hurt you, Kenny. That's the thing about him. I mean, he does have good psychology. He does sell well. But his instinct is to have the big, grandiose fireworks of a spot. And he's gonna slug off the basics for the pomp and circumstance, and that's what he did here. It was still good stuff. Doing a springboard was springboard dive on a bad leg was no bueno for me. Again, I thought it cheapened his selling and the narrative that he was doing throughout the match. Sometimes, you know, less is more or work smarter. And I think sometimes Omega just, he's just too excited and wound up and wanting to do this epic where, you know, just tell the story, brother. And we'll get with you. You're over. You tell the story. And I felt at moments here, and we've seen Kenny Omega has a huge online following, and he's earned it. And he's a deserving guy. But he has flaws in how he works, in my opinion. I liked him and Suzuki. And if you can't get behind Minoru Suzuki with that music, you have a problem.
I think part of the thing with Kenny is it's the same as the Young Bucks. I think he wants to do this stuff. I don't think he even necessarily thinks it's what the crowd wants or that it's best for the match all the time. It's like he wants to wrestle the match the way he wants to wrestle it. And so sometimes he just wants to do these spots because he enjoys it, and it's selfish, and it's not about the match or the quality of the match or it getting over for the fans or anything. Because you're right, I mean, the guy's so over at this point, I think he could do anything and he's going to get a reaction. So yeah, I think it's honestly kind of self-flagellating.
Yeah, fair enough. I felt we got a really I thought it was night two was a big step down from night one.
Yeah, I agree with you. Not bad, but definitely not a bad, step down from night one.
Yeah, still had good moments, but yeah, definitely not. It wasn't like the Grand Slam night one was. But we move into night three, and we got Nagata versus Goto. What you make of this?
I enjoyed it. 3.25 star. I think it's very interesting to show the level that Nagata is, that even he is taking heat from Goto when Goto's usually the guy who instantly sells for everyone. It just shows where his level is on the pecking order. From there, I thought that Nagata, I mean, his strikes look great. The chops and the throws are back and forth. Nice near falls. Looks like, you know, the crowd is into it. It looks like a real fight. It's interesting because they use standing kind of strike exchanges as the momentum switch in the middle of the match. And I really thought about how common that really is in Japanese wrestling. And it's even becoming more and more common.
And on the indie scene.
Yeah, and it's just, I think it's kind of tired, honestly, and it's...
It is.
And there's so many better ways that you can do interesting stuff and cool little tweaks. Like, you're talking about with Suzuki. I mean, the momentum change that Suzuki kicks the guardrail out from Kenny Omega while he's going for the moonsault is way cooler than just a momentum change because they stand there and punch each other. Goto eventually gets the win with the GDR. It feels like a hard-fought battle. Like I said, 3.25. I didn't get super excited for it, but these guys are both good workers. Everything looks snug. Everything looks good, and the crowd pops for everything. So it's funny because they're almost, even though Nagata did get a nice run with the IWGP champion at one point, these guys are almost kind of mirror each other for different reasons, and that I think they perennially were kind of not looked at as top guys in the company by the people doing the booking. But the crowd is solidly behind them, and they have that kind of old-school fighter, grappler style.
I totally agree with you there. I give it 3.5. I like Nagata after the arm early on. Again, the crowd is hot for all this action. And I really thought that we got a great moment in the post-match where the whole entire crowd stands up for Nagata and just wants to touch him and be part of history. and I thought they did a great job. Now all he's got to do is find that tape and play it and see if he can send it for a happy birthday. I thought it was good. What about you?
Yeah, I agree with you.
All right, where am I at?
Makabe versus Ishii.
Okay. Yeah, we got Ishii versus Makabe. One of the most overrated matchups ever is these two guys. I've always had a problem with it for the most part. I like this match, with that said. I thought those sternum bumps from Makabe were nuts, absolutely nuts. Makabe off the top of I hate those strikes that Makabe does off the top of Ishii's heads. Just looks like shit. It just looks like he's like skipping rocks on water when he's throwing like a lariat on top of Makabe's head. It looks phony. It wasn't as bad as it was like a year or two ago at one of the matches where Meltzer was saying it was high end new generation wrestling, covering up for those shitty strikes. But they just look like crap. Both guys are like just bulls, and they just really lay it in here. Really, really, really snug match. I gave it 3 3/4. I really enjoyed what I saw here. What about you?
Yeah, I agree with you so much, and I think it's hard to get that out of your head, that YouTube video putting Dave Meltzer talking about this next level work of God. I can almost like not even remember what Dave was saying, but kind of the no or like working kayfabing, that he's no selling a bad shot that's intentionally bad or whatever the fuck it was. It was like, God damn, dude, it's like not this next level work. It was just botched, shitty looking strikes.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it was this match, and they're just showing them. But this match actually was good. I gave it 3.5 stars. I thought that they were going with the lariats instead of the punches more. And lariats are just old school wrestling. Instead of doing closed fists, they definitely have a lot of, like, kind of built-in history in Japanese wrestling. And they look better. It's like, sometimes, like, just don't, unless you have a really good punch, unless you're Jerry Lawler or Dick Murdoch, you know what I mean? Just don't throw punches. You don't have to. You can throw lariats, you can throw forearms, you can throw whatever strike you throw that looks good.
Yeah, like Ric Flair, he said his punches sucked, so he threw chops.
Yeah, exactly. You know? I mean, right? And he picked them up from Wahoo, and I mean, Wahoo probably could throw good punches, because that guy could do pretty much any kind of strike, I think, real, because he would just actually do it. But, like, he kind of picked it up from Wahoo because he said they hurt like hell, and he wanted to kind of do the same thing. It's the same thing. It's pick up something that you can do that looks good and do that, especially because it's wrestling. And I like to pretend that you're not supposed to throw close fist punches every now and then, so just do that. Spider German attempts for the King Kong knee drop. Ishii misses. I like that as the setup for kind of Ishii taking over towards the end. I like Ishii getting the win here, like I said, and I agree with you. I think that this was one of their better matches for two guys who usually have pretty shitty matches together.
That people praise as classics on top of it.
Right.
I'm all for people having their own opinion, but God, I've never been able to get on that bandwagon come close to jumping on that bandwagon. Then we got Zack Sabre Jr. versus Kota Ibushi, man. What you make of this, brother?
Well, if I wasn't already blocked by Frey, I would say that I was going to get blocked, but you're definitely going to get blocked for bad-mouthing anything from New Japan tonight.
I'm already blocked. So
oh, perfect.
I'm good.
So we're both good. Yeah. So yeah, this match. This was my original prediction for the finals of the Cruiserweight Classic almost 2 years ago at this point, or maybe a year ago at this point. And it finally happens here in the G1. So I'm pleasantly surprised, because I think I probably got a better match out of it because of that. I loved Zach looking for a foot pick, and Kota just throws a fucking punch to the jaw. That popped me so goddamn hard. I loved that as the opening of the match. From there, I love the snapmares back and forth. Zach does that quick neck crank in between the ankles, but he holds it crossed and he grabs Coda's leg from there. I just thought that was fantastic. And yeah, I mean, it was so perfect as the first kind of big thing he does, and then it leads into the neck work. There was some talk of some people being a little, oh, what's going to happen when Zack tries to do limb work on Coda? Coda's limb work is so shitty. And I'm like, I mean, I thought it was very clear in the Naito match that Coda's going to be selling that neck this whole tournament. I mean, that's the story of the tournament, is Coda's neck. Yeah. So Zack's got plenty of great neck work, and he shows it off here in kind. He's working over the neck and head the whole time. Goes to the arm. I like he breaks the full Nelson with the kind of World of Sporty, you grab underneath your knee, pop the
Billy
full
Robinson.
Nelson.
Yeah, it's special. Yep.
Yeah, I love that spot. But then from there, he grabs the arm and kicks it so that he can then quickly transition into the octopus where he pulls a straight armbar in the octopus. And I just love that. It's like, neck, boom, okay, I kicked the arm, for the arm for a second. And I just like that flurry of three big moves to the arm, back-to-back-to-back that way. From there, he catches a kick and transitions into the ankle lock, into the STF, and he's just killer, just folding this guy in half. And I love that. This is a thing that I love about Zack. I mean, the guy is like a shark. When he smells blood, when he sees it, he focuses in on that weakness, and he stays on it. And here in New Japan, I mean, he really gets rewarded for that strong work. And it makes me think when I was talking about how, oh, I'm not liking Zack as much on the U.S. Indies. Oh, I thought Zack was better in Noah. Now I'm realizing why. There's a certain style of work that he can do in Japan that those crowds, number one, like. And number two, the wrestlers that he works with give him something. I mean, that opening, the punch from Coda was just such a great thing. And I talked about it with Tanahashi giving him a lot of kind of... fight back and forth. It really makes it so that Zack has to up that killer instinct because he's going against a guy who's actually fighting him instead of kind of showing off in a match where he just kind of looks like he's exhibitioning against people. So I love that. I love Coda catches the charging lifter into the backslide, but he rolls Zack through further so that he's on his knees and knees him in the face. That just looked fucking great. And then Zack grabs the triangle, which was my prediction for the match, when I was talking about how would Kota Ibushi, you know, he's not going to sell his limbs very well. I said, I think Zack's going to win this with a triangle. There's not going to be any limb work. It's going to be on the neck. It's going to be a choke. But he gets picked up out of the triangle into the last ride. Again, perfect setup using one guy's a normal move that he uses the triangle to set up into another guy's finisher, the last ride powerbomb. So I just love playing off each other that way. And I gave this 4.5 stars. These guys matched up together so fucking well for their first time matchup against each other. You would think that they're old rivals, the way that they went back and forth. They used every bit of time that they had to have just all action, but also plenty of selling, plenty of storytelling. The only thing I think you could complain is that there was not a lot out of Coda here, but I think Coda took an ass whooping here, and I think Zack filled the time of the match super well to make it really believable coming out of it.
I totally agree. I gave it 4.25. I thought Zack Sabre working on that neck twister and hold on looked freaking nasty, and Zack's all over that neck. I like he's using cravats and lifters at the neck. Zack Sabre with that, he goes, I loved how he used a leg crab just so he's able to stomp on Coda's neck. Absolutely loved it. Because you're like, oh, why is he transitioning to the leg? Oh, no, he's not. He's using it to hold his neck in place so he can stomp the shit out of it. Absolutely loved it. I loved Coda's comebacks and stuff in it. But, man, I thought Zack was super nasty here. And he felt like he got some of the Minoru Suzuki vibe to him, you know, like, hey, it's not just about submissions, but it's about how you apply them and let's torture these bastards. And that's what he did. He just tortured Coda throughout the match, and it was fantastic. Then we got Fale and Tanahashi. Good match. I talked about earlier, I really like these stripped down Tanahashi matches. This was about him selling, making like comeback hope spots, and then making a comeback. And I'm glad they burnt a 20 count as the finisher here, because it helps them do it. Because Japan fans by that 20 count as a real near great near fall. And now that you give it credibility that, yeah, you could lose on it, it just adds, gives that spot a lot more heat throughout the tournament. So good job there. I felt they used it perfectly on a match that no one was super invested in type of thing. And a good way to protect Folly from a pin, I guess, too. I give it 3.25 stars. What about you?
I gave it 3.5. And I'm right there with you. I love Tanahashi skinning the cat with one arm. I liked the beginning with Tanahashi kind of testing the waters, seeing if he could pick Fale up for the power bombs and stuff like that, but he just can't. I liked Fale showing off his strength advantage, but Tanahashi's this plucky underdog, never say die, using his quickness and what strength he has. And then when it transitions to Fale, then he goes after the arm, and I mean, then it's like he's not just this monster, but he's also going after an injury. I kind of love that, you know, and then he's after the arm there, and that adds a little wrinkle to it as well, instead of just, he's just the big man, you know, and so that's really cool. Earthquake splash, standing splash, Tanahashi kicks out of both. I think that's great stuff, and I mean, the crowd is just super into everything. The bad luck fall countered into the sling blade was great. High fly flow to the ground was fantastic, and then the count out was perfect. I mean, I agree with you. Do it early. Establish it as a possible finish. Perfect match for it. I mean, realistically, with Tanahashi having a bad arm going against a guy this big, I couldn't have believed him putting him away. So you get him the win in a way that's believable. Like you said, still protect Fale. And fantastic stuff all around.
Agreed. And then we got Naito versus Yoshihashi. What'd you go with this, brother?
I liked it, but I think I probably would have expected more from them, honestly, in some ways. I thought that Yoshihashi really kind of checked out. I mean, he didn't check out, but he was selling really well, but I would have liked to have seen a lot more for him. I think in a main event setting like this, for a guy who should be getting established, I would have liked a lot more offense from Yoshihashi. Really felt like he took an ass-whooping for too long at times. He's not really following that steambook rule of like coming back every three moves at least with something of his own. That said, again, as I said, I thought his selling was good. I think Naito is able to add a lot of ruthlessness to his character that I enjoy a lot out of him. I think that he's super believable as an asshole on top, just working guys over. I liked that towards the end, after Yoshihashi had gotten a brief comeback and he hit the shoulder breaker and the power bomb with the jackknife cover, from there he shows a lot more urgency, a lot more attempting to fight off Naito. After the beginning of the match, it really felt like he was just kind of sitting back and just letting himself get beat up. From there, he's really starting to show some fight. But it did start to feel like maybe it was too late for him to finally check into the match. The butterfly lock for a long time, and then he rolls back into the middle of the ring, I thought was a good spot from Yoshihashi. But again, feels like more of a babyface thing to fight and valiantly get that rope after a long time in a submission hold there. That said, I thought that the ending itself was definitely hot, back and forth, lots of back and forth. And I like Naito's finishing move being very, very kind of versatile, but also very kind of treated a lot less protected than a lot of other finishing moves in New Japan, which I think is kind of interesting to say that I like a finishing move not being protected. But when he's the only one who has a finishing move that's kind of not protected, it makes it special. So you know what to expect. He hits different variations of the Destino, but he usually has to hit that clean setup Destino to get the pin almost every time. I gave this 3.25 star. Like I said, I was hoping for a lot more star-making performance for Yoshihashi, but realistically, I think Naito is very good, but I think he showed here that he can't necessarily kind of have a match that's about getting somebody else over as well.
Agreed. I enjoyed it. I went 3.75. I thought the match went a little long, but with that said, it finally heated up down the stretch. I liked Yoshihashi's selling of all of Naito's neck work. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed Yoshihashi working over Naito's back. I enjoyed that. But the finishing stretch was really hot, got hot. And you believed the key point here, though, is down the stretch, I did believe that Yoshihashi could pull off an upset. It didn't happen, but the key part was me believing in that segment, and I did. So it overall worked for me. 3 3/4. It could have been, like you said, it could have been tighter, but I still enjoyed what we got. Another good showing out of the A block. They've definitely outperformed B block so far.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think the A block is the killer block so far. I can't imagine too many matches disappointing on the A block. That said, I mean, Naito is obviously a big star, but a setting like this, I think that that Zack Sabre Jr. match on this night probably should have been the main event.
Exactly. With that note, why don't we close her up? What do you have going on, Tim? Where can people find you?
Just over on Place to Be Pop feed. I got a new interview coming out shortly when you're listening to this with one of the new podcast hosts, Pete Winston from Greetings from Allentown. It's a lot of fun talking to him, so check that one out. Otherwise, just follow me on Twitter at Lucha Undead.
Sounds great. Follow me on Twitter at Titans O' Wrestling. I was over on, I did a show with Will where I reunited with most of the Titans. And I was just on with Nate and Scott Crisola last night talking some G1 and some Russell Circus. So look for me there. But I'll catch you guys later. Keep up with wrestling this week. G1, G1, G1. And whatever else time, whatever other stuff you have time for. Have a great week.
Hey, Caesar's. Hey.